Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. We're broadcasting all over the world, and we're in support of our local station, WBAI, and we originate out of the Progressive Radio Network in New York City. I'd like to welcome all of you. 2 weeks, and we're at the completion of our on-campus anti-aging clinical study. The final day of that, I'm going to invite all the participants to come on air and give you at least what they can tell you has improved. They won't know their blood work up. That's the day they actually get their blood work up done in the morning. And then we'll see what objective anti-aging markers, did we lengthen their telomeres? Did we increase the DNA and repair the DNA? Did we slow down the aging process? So all this is going to be known in just 2 weeks. Today, we're going to start by looking at how research from published in Pediatrics Daily News is linking fluoride to the developing brains, and that's not good. So when a young person has fluoridated water that they're drinking, it's linked to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And that's according to the Environmental International. We're going to have more on that, along with a lot of other health and nutrition information. Also today, I'm going to do several commentaries. I'm going to play a little tape for you, and you can watch it as well, on Professor Rupert Sheldrake. Now, who's he? He's my guest tonight. He'll continue with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. The topic, Recovering the Experience of Spiritual Wonder in an Age of Scientific Materialism and Atheism. And by the way, he's heavy. He's a fellow at Cambridge University, a Frank Knotts fellow at Harvard University, and a research fellow at the British Royal Society. And his critics, well, one of them hangs pictures at Walmart. I guess they're equal in their knowledge of things such as consciousness. We're going to take that on tonight, 7 o'clock. But I'm going to play you a clip for all of those who will not able to listen in to give you at least one of his insights. It'll be interesting. Also today, I'm going to be sharing a commentary, time permitting, Death by Oligarchy by Chris Hedges from Truthdig. And I want to give just a few insights, just a few, about this upcoming impeachment set of hearings that are going to occur. We also have some additional audio clips about sick children after their exposure to 4 and 5G small cell installations out in Sacramento. This was a hearing. And also a mother from Arkansas obliterates Common Core in 4 minutes. So that's our program. And I want to set aside a few minutes today to discuss my perspective on the attempted coup of WBAI and what I am now learning that should be of interest to our listeners and the management of the station. But we begin always with the latest on health and healing. I wrote an article that is still being updated on a regular basis starting over 40 years ago. It's called The Fluoride Fiasco. And we bring it up to date, always with proper peer-reviewed scientific citations, and it just keeps getting worse. But the latest is that fluoridation, which is the purposeful addition of non-essential fluoride chemicals into public water supplies, attempts to reduce tooth decay in your tap water. It doesn't. And fluoride is presumed to be a cognitive neurodevelopmental hazard to humans. That's according to the USHHS's Health and Human Services National Toxicological Program monograph and systematic review of fluoride exposure and neurodevelopmental and cognitive health defects. So that's just out last month. Here's their conclusion, quote, "This conclusion is based upon a consistent pattern of findings in human studies across several different populations showing that higher fluoride exposure is associated with a decreased IQ or other cognitive impairments in children." So don't use fluoridated water. Filter it. From the Institute of Salud Carlos in Spain, walnuts If you eat them on a regular basis for 2 years, they're associated with a decreased loss of telomere length, and that's a major sign of aging when you can slow down the loss of your telomeres. Now, exercise will slow it down. A plant-based diet slows it down. Meditation slows it down. Qigong can slow it down. Tai Chi can slow it down. Yoga can slow it down. And proper supplementation really slows it down. So this is just one more thing that we should do within that diet is have. Now, you can have walnuts as just a handful of walnuts. Or you can have walnut butter, which is simply where they put it in a machine, just break it down to make it easier to digest if you are having trouble digesting high and hard fibrous material. But get that in, because this was a randomized controlled trials, and it was based upon the shortening of leukocyte telomere length, and it worked. According to the study out of Barcelona, it slowed down the telomeres, and that is what you want. From Michigan State University comes a study about how meditation can help you make fewer mistakes. So if you're forgetful or make mistakes when in a hurry, a new study from Michigan State University, the largest of its kind to date, found that meditation could help you to become less error-prone. The researchers published in Brain Sciences tested how open monitoring meditation, or meditation that focuses awareness on feelings and thoughts and sensations as they unfold in one's mind, altered brain activity in a way that suggests increased error recognition. Now, I teach a form of meditation. It is a form of conscious meditation. And I'll give you an idea. Let's just say that you would normally walk around a property and then come back, and let's say it takes 20 minutes to walk around the property. And then you'd be asked a question. What did you see? And then a person would explain what they saw. Now try it again, but this time be completely focused as if your brain were a radar and it's scanning from side to side. And as you walk, you're looking to see if anything needs addressing, if anything's out of the ordinary, if anything is out of place. And if it is, make note of that. Then they go around and they come back, and lo and behold, they find a lot of more things that they weren't aware of. What did they see in the first time? Of course, your eyes seeing everything that's in front of you, but you're not registering that as important. Now, go around again. The third time when you go around, be conscious of everything, but also be conscious of the birds and tell me how many birds are singing. And they come back, so I didn't even hear birds the first two times, but this time I counted 10 birds. So each time we challenge ourselves to become more aware of our presence in the moment, like a mindful presence, and that helps to overcome what I call the dead horse syndrome. Now, what's the dead horse syndrome? How many times in your life have you asked someone, maybe a son or daughter or a spouse, don't make a mess? And then you come in and you find that they made a mess. And then you ask them to clean up the mess. So they will, first they'll argue, and then they'll clean it up. And then you say, but you didn't clean up the mess beside it. Well, you didn't tell me to clean up the mess beside it. So what we become very monofocused. And so this is why we can walk by things and not know that they need attendant. And then we begin to look at ourselves or people in our lives and don't pay attention that they need also attending to, until one day there's a crisis. So it's just another way of paying attention. It's done through mastery and discipline and repetition until you get it right. And hence, people who do pay attention tend to make fewer mistakes because they're monitoring their environment and monitoring how they think to recognize errors, recognize limitations, recognize something is not right, and stop and address it. From Tianjin University Medical School in China comes a study about apples. And they found a chemical in the apple called florizin, P-H-L-O-R-I-Z-I-N. And what does it do? It reduces your plasma cholesterol, and that helps you not to have atherosclerotic plaque. So an apple a day does make a difference, and it keeps our atherosclerosis away. We knew the quercetin in the apple was good, and quercetin helps keep your skin younger longer, helps repair your internal tissues. If you bruise, it'll help heal a bruise faster. A cut or wound, it helps it heal faster. Keeps your skin tighter because it's one of the necessary elements, along with vitamin C, to creating new collagen. From Sydney University of Technology, quitting Facebook could boost exam results. Yeah. In research that validates what many parents and educators suspect, students whose grades are below average could boost their results if they devoted less time to Facebook and other social networking sites. So that's just common sense. Okay, then the question is, how do you wean people away, adults as well, from excess screen time when they're so used to spending time on it? Research Institute of Environmental Medicine, which is in Germany, published in the British Journal of Dermatology, found that lycopene, lyco, L-Y-C-O-P-E-N-E, P-E-N-E, and lutein, L-U-T-E-I-N, protects your skin against ultraviolet radiation. So that's two really good things. So if you're eating tomatoes or tomato sauces, tomato juice, you're getting a lot of both nutrients, and that can help you. And it also shows that a lycopene can help slow down the aging process. Maybe that's one of the reasons that people in the Mediterranean area, the Western Mediterranean, have a longer lifespan than those in the Eastern Mediterranean. Eastern Mediterranean, they have more of the salted meats and food. In the Western Mediterranean, they have more of the tomato-based foods. From Kyoto Pharmaceutical University in Japan comes a study about garlic and how it induces apoptosis, which is programmed cell death, and especially with effusion lymphoma. And the chemical is called diol, D-I-A-L-L-Y-L, trisulfide, T-R-I-S-U-L-F-I-D-E, diol trisulfide. It's in garlic. And when you lightly saute garlic, so it's just translucent over low flame, it releases even more of it. One more reason why garlic can help with cancer. And a strong link is found between the level of depression, heart disease, and stroke. This is from the American Heart Association, a scientific session that just happened. And they say the severity of a person's depression can increase their odds of having heart disease and stroke. So one more reason why we should be paying more attention to our emotions and how we can get them to a better place, more mindful in a positive way. Improving fitness can mean living longer without dementia. Norwegian University of Science and Technology. Yep, published in the Lancet Health, Public Health. So what's the takeaway message? It's simple. Staying fit or improving fitness over time should be a goal for anyone who wants to reduce the likelihood of getting dementia. And if you have dementia, it's important to help that person exercise, even if they have to go very slow. Work with them. That exercise means all the difference in the world. And let's say they're in a wheelchair. Well, one of the things you can do is you can do it for 5 minutes, hold their feet, and then up against your chest, then have them push with their legs. So they're using their thighs, their hamstrings, their glutes, and their calves. And when they push up, bring your hand back. So in effect, you're giving and taking. As each leg comes back, your hand is going back, but you're not allowing them just to go easy. You're putting in some, let's say, resistance, and that'll help those muscles. You should do that 3 times a day. That will help. Makes a difference. And it can cut the risk of dementia almost in half. We are 15 minutes in our program, and we're finished with our health and nutrition segment. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to go directly into the hearing on 4G, 5G. Now, I posted our latest article yesterday about the clutter in space, and we wanted to do something different to show you how irresponsible Elon Musk and these other tech companies are to get up there to make a profit off the internet, but not caring about how they're creating a wasteland, a dangerous one, with all the satellites that they're putting in the air. Another 100 just went up yesterday, by the way. So we want you to hear the dangers of 4G and 5G. And it starts off with a kid. She's only on about 15 seconds. Then the parent takes over. And this is before a small cell installation city council meeting in Sacramento. It's not long, but we should be demanding these meetings in every city in the United States. Back in a moment.
To talk about the cell antennas in my front yard. I can no longer sleep in my own room because of it. Please move the cell antennas so our lives can go back to normal again. Thank you.
To my little girls, I'm a little choked up. In late December, Verizon installed a very powerful cell antenna right outside my daughter's window. About a month after the antenna was installed, both of my daughters came down with cold and flu-like symptoms. Another month passed, and my daughters were still ill. We began to wonder if the recently installed antennas could be affecting their health. My brother Noah, who is the scientist in the family, began researching the safety of cell antennas and the radiation that they emit. He found hundreds of studies and experts warning about the dangers of wireless radiation, including immune system suppression, which I believe my daughters have suffered, and cancer, one of the diseases we all fear the most. He's also found that guidelines designed to protect us from this wireless radiation are based on the outdated assumption that the only biological effect caused by wireless radiation is heating. More recent research, particularly research looking at long-term chronic exposure, like we are being subjected to by this antenna, has disproven this outdated assumption. Every single day, we wonder if we are being harmed by Verizon antenna, if our DNA is being changed, if our children will get cancer because of the antenna. It is a terrible way to live, and it has been inflicted upon us against our will. We have put up metal shielding in our home that helps to reduce our exposure, but it is still very high. About a week after we installed the shielding and 2 months into their illness, my daughter's symptoms went away. To me, this is just more evidence that we have been harmed by Verizon's antenna. We are asking you today to do more to help us get this antenna turned off. Thank you.
Aaron McMahon.
Good evening, Mayor and City Council members. My name is Aaron McMahon. As you all know by now, my family owns a home. I'm coming to speak tonight again about the 5G expansion project in the city of Sacramento, as well as the antenna that was installed in front of my house on Light Pole. Basically, I'm here tonight because we are about 4 months in this process, and we have still not gotten any of our answers. We have corresponded with the FCC. We have corresponded with the city of Sacramento. We have corresponded with Verizon, U.S. Congresswoman Matsui. A lot of these places are starting to shut down and not even correspond with us anymore. And we're just at a loss. We do not know what to do anymore. We're talking about putting my house, my dream house that I worked very hard to get, my family's dream house, my wife's dream house, on the market because we do not feel it is safe for our children. I assume that the majority of you, if not all of you, are parents and I just really would like to know what you would do in my situation. To say this process has been frustrating would be a huge understatement. I've grown up in the city my whole life. I was born at Kaiser South in 1980, and I've always been proud of the city of Sacramento and proud of our government. I've lost faith in the last 4 months with this process. I just don't understand how this is okay. As elected city officials, is it not one of your primary responsibilities to protect the health and well-being of your constituents? We've gotten the runaround from absolutely everyone involved, and still none of our questions have been answered. Again, the FCC has stopped corresponding with us. Verizon, their corporate attorney, reached out to us last week and basically told us good luck.
Your time is up, but I want to take...
Okay, we have dozens of testimonies from around the country. The trouble is, many of these committees already have their mind made up. They're very biased. Much of it's political. And we also have seen with the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, they go in secretly behind the scenes at the state level. They groom the legislators, your legislators at the state level, at these luxurious resorts. They give them a bill that they have written, meaning the 200 to 250 major corporations that control our entire government. They give the legislators a bill, say, now take this back to the state and pass it as your own. And as a result, we don't hold our state legislators accountable. Most people don't even know what a person at the state legislator does or any of the bills they work on. And this is how they've been successful in bringing us to this state of being. Something that has not gotten the attention it deserves is, why did Hillary Clinton smear Tulsi Gabbard and Jill Stein? Jill's not running for anything. She's back in practice as a pediatrician up in Boston. What was the purpose of it? Well, who better to discuss this than Max Blumenthal, one of America's most courageous and honest investigative reporters and journalists.
Welcome to Pushback. I'm Aaron Maté, here with Max Blumenthal, the senior editor of The Gray Zone, author of several books, including his latest, The Management of Savagery. Max, we're talking today about Hillary Clinton's comments about Tulsi Gabbard and Jill Stein, Clinton calling Stein a Russian asset and suggesting that the Russians are, quote, grooming Tulsi Gabbard to run as a third-party candidate. This seemingly came out of nowhere, but then you had a parade of Clinton flunkies, people who worked for her or who are associated with her, coming out to also slam Tulsi Gabbard in this way. So it seemed kind of coordinated. Whatever it was shocking to see, and the reaction has been quite striking. Tulsi Gabbard hit back pretty hard. What do you make of what Hillary Clinton said today and why she said it?
Well, I think people won't be surprised with my reaction to it. And, you know, I agree with everything that you've said on Twitter and elsewhere. But I think it's important to look a little deeper at what's going on here. First of all, one of the reasons that you and I were really so disgusted with the narrative of Russiagate was that we saw what was coming down the pike. And I said so in early 2017, that this whole narrative would blow back on the left and would be used to enforce conformity on issues of war and peace in support of the former against the latter. And we're seeing that play out in real time with Hillary Clinton's attacks on Tulsi Gabbard. It was clear to me as soon as Tulsi Gabbard got into the race that even though she has absolutely no connection to Russia at all, she was going to be smeared this way because this is the McCarthyite venomous poison that Hillary Clinton has brought into the Democratic Party, along with the national security state figures like John Brennan, James Clapper. I mean, basically, they have turned principled resistance against Trump and Trumpism into a collection of spooks, dupes, and Cold War kooks. And our worst warnings are being fulfilled. Tulsi Gabbard has been smeared as a Russian asset. She's been basically accused of committing a crime that could hold the death penalty. by someone with a multi-million dollar sleaze operation. Not only that, Jill Stein, who's basically back to, I think, like private practice as a pediatrician in Boston, who has no political network at all, was also called a Russian agent by Hillary Clinton. Now, the first point I want to make is that if we're going to look a little bit deeper at this, this was a coordinated attack, and Tulsi Gabbard in her response hinted at part of the logic behind it, which is that Hillary Clinton has several candidates in the race who, you know, their campaigns are staffed by Hillary Clinton's former staff. They're basically representing the politics of Clintonism in the race. And this is their way of destroying an emergent trend in the party, which is somewhat nonpartisan, but is also, you know, anti-war, which reflects the sentiments of Americans across the country, including a lot of the working class people who are, you know, following Trump into the Republican Party. It was coordinated. The question was it wise? Was it wise for Hillary Clinton and her sleaze network, her corporate funded sleaze network, which really grew out of her campaign where she just had so much Wall Street money and defense industry money and money coming from all of these elite quarters that she was just giving all her buddies little payoffs here and there. And now they're just kind of lurking out there looking for something to direct their sleaze at. And it becomes Tulsi Gabbard. A lot of Americans respected and admired Hillary Clinton, especially women, for standing up to Donald Trump, for like standing up to him in the debates, going toe to toe with someone who is clearly a sexist bully. But now she's attacking a young woman, one of the youngest people to actually run in a Democratic primary, who served on the front lines in combat in the evil war that Hillary Clinton cheerled and voted for in Iraq. And she's punching down against someone, a veteran, calling her a traitor, who doesn't have a multi-million dollar sleaze operation, who is a minor protest candidate, and she's punching down against a pediatrician in Boston. This makes Hillary Clinton not only look conspiratorial, it makes her look like a sadistic bully, it makes her look Trumpian. And so we have to question the wisdom of this, because Hillary Clinton isn't actually running for anything. But it appears that she's trying to clear space for figures like Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, who feel, especially Kamala Harris, who feel really threatened by Tulsi Gabbard and who actually got humiliated by Tulsi Gabbard on stage. So that's what I think is going on here. I do think it shows kind of a split in the party on foreign policy, and it shows that one wing of the party no longer cares about reality. They don't care about facts. They've been so inculcated into the paranoia of the new Cold War, that conspiratorial thinking, that they actually believe that this has an impact. It started with Moscow Mitch. No one challenged Moscow Mitch. No one cared about, you know, this kind of oligarchic Kentucky Republican who's the Senate Majority Leader being smeared on the progressive left, even though there was very little basis for calling him that. And the Clinton wing of the party and the DNC party elites, they got this libidinal satisfaction out of calling Mitch McConnell Moscow Mitch. So then they move on to Tulsi Gabbard. And I think we're seeing them start to get some pushback. The question is, who's next? And I think the next target is inevitable. It's a Jewish socialist who took a trip to the USSR and Nicaragua, who actually challenges the Clinton wing of the party in a much more substantial way than Tulsi Gabbard. And so I see this as a pilot program for the next phase of attacks.
It also could be a warning to Sanders and his supporters to basically shut up, or they're going to face what Tulsi Gabbard just faced. And it could be a warning to them to basically not adopt the positions that Tulsi Gabbard has come to embody, especially being against the regime change wars that Hillary Clinton has started and represents. And I'm wondering if, you know, this attack on Tulsi Gabbard coming in the aftermath of Trump's withdrawal from Syria, and Trump in the aftermath of that has tried to portray himself as the anti-war candidate again, even though in reality he is far from it. And I couldn't help but thinking today if this attack on Tulsi Gabbard was sort of designed to, you know, basically send a message to any Democrat wanting to take the reins of the anti-war message from Trump, and to say, no, actually, we're the party that stands for being against regime change wars, and we're not going to be supporting things like the Saudi war on Yemen like Trump is, or warmongering against Iran, or imposing murderous sanctions on Venezuela. If going after Tulsi and smearing her as a Russian agent and her anti-war views being a result of having ties to Russia or sympathies with Russia, if that is at play here as well.
Well, it's the rhetorical basis for Hillary Clinton's smear was established during the past 2 years when anyone who challenged the imperatives of the national security state in places like Syria or Venezuela, where the proxy war is playing out between the U.S. and Russia, although, you know, it's not purely a proxy war, but it's seen that way in Washington, is accused of echoing Kremlin propaganda. And so we saw that narrative weaponized against Tulsi Gabbard after the last debate. I've never seen such a meltdown among, you know, Beltway and Democratic establishment hacks over a minor protest candidate who's polling at 2% as the one I saw against Tulsi Gabbard, Susan Glasser from Politico, who's, you know, just the quintessential centrist hack who's married to Peter Baker, the New York Times White House correspondent, said that Tulsi Gabbard was echoing Russian and Syrian talking points by condemning regime change wars. This is, you know, something that only the real cranks of the Republican Party would have said about opponents of the Iraq War. Now it's coming out of the political center. Josh Marshall, founder of Talking Points Memo, which all of the kind of, you know, Democratic wonks wake up every morning and read. He said the only thing that Tulsi Gabbard can do is shut the F up. I mean, that was his response to her. It's like this just, she inspires this kind of visceral outrage by condemning regime change wars. And one after another, they accuse her of echoing Russian talking points. So now, championing the cause of peace, withdrawing U.S. troops, withdrawing U.S. bases from a hinterland in northern Syria is it's the Russian agenda. And this is something I've never heard in my lifetime since I was kind of like a sentient being following politics. But it's something that I read about in books about McCarthyism. And it really appears to have so infested the mainstream of the Democratic Party that we're going to be living with it for the rest of our lives. Why? Because the world is changing before us. And Russia and China are forming a bloc against U.S. unipolarism. And it was in the 90s when the unipolar moment of kind of imperial bliss consumed the Beltway political class, and Bill Clinton was in power to enjoy that moment. So everyone in the Democratic establishment who supported Hillary Clinton's 2016 run, they're nostalgic for that moment. And Putin and Xi are basically ruining it by pushing back against the U.S. in these areas where the U.S. is an extremely toxic presence. And that's what's kind of playing out in our politics. And so many of the people who are leveling these attacks, they really have skin in the game. They really believe in the U.S. as a benevolent imperial force. Tulsi Gabbard, just with a few kind of interruptions in the debate, has managed to kind of disrupt the narrative that Bernie Sanders actually failed to disrupt in 2016. He wasn't as focused on foreign policy. By challenging sanctions, Tulsi Gabbard does that. And so, yes, I agree with you. They're trying to make an example of her the same way they've tried to make an example of us, Aaron, in media. It's the same tactic to try to prevent other young journalists from following in our footsteps and taking up this mantle of challenging empire.
Thankfully, we have mirrors and we have to look at ourselves in the mirror. And that mirror, I think, leaves us no choice but to continue doing what we're doing, especially just given how unbelievably insane all this is. You know, you mentioned Xi and Putin. I want to read you a tweet from Samantha Power today. She writes, so she retweets Hillary Clinton's comments about Tulsi Gabbard.
I didn't know that. That's wild.
And she says, 2016 election was won by 78,000 votes spread among three states. Absent third-party candidates, Hillary Clinton would have won, and Donald Trump would not now be harming Americans and our friends and aiding autocrats. If Tulsi Gabbard runs, it would be a huge windfall for Trump, Assad, Putin, Xi.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to say about that. I also saw Samantha Power blame Trump or accuse Trump of calling for ethnic cleansing in northern Syria. It's a comment I never heard Samantha Power make about, for example, Benjamin Netanyahu, who was carrying out ethnic cleansing every day in historic Palestine, while Samantha Power was in the State Department or at the UN and had the power to do something about it. In fact, she backed up Netanyahu. But, you know, to the specific point that Samantha Power made, it is the you know, you had this freak out from Ben Rhodes about RT correspondents being on what was once a U.S. base that had been abandoned in northern Syria. Why were those U.S. bases there? Why did this whole dynamic come into play? It's because of the agenda of Samantha Power playing out in Syria. Samantha Power was one of the biggest champions of arming the so-called moderate rebels in Syria. There's this great line in a Jeffrey Goldberg article about Samantha Power constantly bothering Obama, talking about the so-called rebels as, you know, just a bunch of carpenters and fathers and regular farmers who just need weapons to defend themselves with. So she was always pushing the arm and equip program. Meanwhile, you have the Defense Intelligence Agency memo in 2012, which was suppressed by the Obama State Department until 2015, which warned of the rise of a Salafist principality in northeastern Syria if this arm and equip program persisted and if Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Turkey continued to participate in supporting these Islamist insurgents inside Syria that Samantha Power also wanted to arm. And that's the direct result of the program that Samantha Power put into place that ISIS developed and that Jabhat al-Nusra, the local al-Qaeda affiliate, became the frontline fighting force of the armed opposition to the Syrian government. And John Kerry, the Secretary of State, in leaked audio, in a conversation with Syrian opposition activists, explained very clearly and accurately why Russia was on the Syrian battlefield, why the Russian military intervened. And it was because, in his words, we were watching ISIS advance, suggesting that the U.S. was hoping ISIS would advance. And he said, we hoped that it would force Assad to the table to negotiate a transition. But then Russia came in and stopped their advance. And that's exactly what happened. Russia entered because they were not inclined to see, the Russian government was not inclined to see a country that's as far away from Russian frontiers as Washington, D.C. is from West Virginia, be overrun by Wahhabi extremists and for genocide to take place. This would have destabilized the entire region. Iran had its own reasons for being in Syria as well that also related to deterrence and its own national interest. Hezbollah had its reasons for going in, preventing the penetration of Salafi jihadi forces in Lebanon. They basically saved Lebanon from this catastrophe. And so all of these forces converge in Syria as invited allies who are there according to international law to oust the forces that were being supported by Samantha Power. And now you have a dynamic where Russia and Iran, along with the Syrian government, are in the catbird seat because their strategy succeeded. But if Samantha Power and her fellow Responsibility to Protect military humanists had never enacted this insane dirty war on Syria, there wouldn't be a direct Russian presence there, except for maybe the Russian naval base in Tartus. There wouldn't be the presence of all of these Shia militias. Hezbollah would have never entered Syria, and untold tens of thousands of people would still be alive. So it's because of Samantha Power and people like her that were facing this moment. And only Tulsi Gabbard has the guts to stand up and say that. And that's why she's being attacked. So it's kind of like we're witnessing a cover up by smearing Tulsi Gabbard and trying to get her to shut up.
And, you know, Max, to take it to what you point out in your book, The Management of Savagery, which I think is essential reading to understand what happened not just to countries targeted by U.S. regime change like Syria and Libya, but also to understand what happened to the U.S. Because, as you point out, it's also these wars that people like Samantha Power and Hillary Clinton and Ben Rhodes have fueled that helped gave us Donald Trump, creating these mass refugee flights, which then xenophobes like Trump have exploited to appeal to the racism of white people in the U.S., a dynamic not just here, but also found in Britain and across Europe. Also exploiting the fact that these wars cost money at home and cost lives at home. And Trump painted himself as being the antithesis of people like Samantha Power and Hillary Clinton, and was able to dupe people into believing that he was anti-war, which helped him actually win these states. So the irony, taking it back to Samantha Power's tweets, of instead of acknowledging the role of her own regime change wars and policies in Trump's victory, she then blames that on third-party candidates like Tulsi Gabbard and says that that will end up empowering these official enemies who policies like hers target and try to destabilize. So the convergence of cynicism here and the convergence of irony and hypocrisy is just very staggering.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say it any better than that. I would just add, you know, from a purely kind of horse race politics point of view, there's a new Suffolk poll out, Suffolk University poll, and it shows outlines all of the issues of importance to Democratic voters. At the top, I think, is healthcare and then jobs and all the kitchen table issues. And at the very bottom, polling around 0% is Russian interference. And so, yeah, I mean, yeah, the decision that was taken by Hillary's camp to base their attack, first of all, select Tulsi Gabbard as a target, and then to second of all, base their attack on the whole Russiagate, new Cold War narrative, shows how out of touch they are and what a bunch of kind of bullying hovercraft elites they are. And I would say the attack does remind me of Donald Trump's verbal assault on Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib. But the difference is, and this is, again, from purely horse race perspective, not, you know, my own, principles. Trump was basing that attack on the sentiments of his own reactionary base, his own grassroots base. I don't know who Hillary Clinton thinks she's speaking to here. But it really does speak to her own failure as a candidate and just this loser mentality that still persists in her inner circle. And it's the mentality of people who are just out of touch with average Americans, who don't care what they think and who've just been kind of on this constant, jet around the world, this State Department jet going from one place to another to prop up a failing empire. It's not really going to work. And so it leads me to believe that Donald Trump, if he gets through this impeachment saga, can get ready for another 4 years in the White House.
And that is a ominous and somber place to leave it, but we will leave it there as it gives us all something to think about going forward. Max Blumenthal, editor of The Gray Zone, author of several books, including The Management of Savagery. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Aaron.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm concerned about everything. I trust nothing. I trust no institution. They have all betrayed us. The religious institutions have betrayed us because, first of all, they're frequently divisive. They identify themselves as unique, and those that aren't, where are they in the streets? Where are they in the ballot box? Where are they at the local level, the state level? Where were they when it came time, the Orthodox community, the ultra-Orthodox community, in protecting those amongst them who did not want their children to receive mandatory vaccines that could end up injuring or killing their children? How about zero? not one. But once they see they have been victimized and they have no choice, or they have to take their kid out of school, then suddenly they yell and scream and say, what about us? What about us? Well, what about you? That's a negative karmic lesson. If you choose not to become involved and you choose not to become aware of how important certain issues are, then sooner or later there's going to be a tipping point and you will be a victim of that. Our banking institution, our financial institutions have betrayed us. They don't care about us. All they care about you, when you can't repay a debt, then they can put you in to 100%, 200%, 500%, 1,000% on payday loans that keeps being rolled over. They can put you into perpetual peonage and debt. Who are these people? Why would we vote for either the Democrats or Republicans? We don't even have a viable third party in our country. Other countries do. Some countries have 20 parties. It's because we are a nation controlled at every single level by oligarchs. Oligarchs are blinded by hubris, wealth, and power. Their cloying sense of entitlement sees them outraged by even the most tepid reforms or mindless of anything that criticizes them. They lack empathy. They lack compassion, along with remorse or guilt, for what is done to those outside of their tiny and elitist circles. And I've mentioned, how big is the circle? Well, at the very center of the circle, where the most powerful are, there's about 2,150. Those are the billionaires. Then there is the circle right outside of that circle, which are the real rich, 100 million to a billion. Then there is the very rich, but not the super rich, who have anywhere from, let's say, 10 million to 100 million. And then you have the largest group, and that's the professional class, your lawyers, doctors, engineers, and with rare exception, everything that matters in their life is, in one word, career. And so where are the people who are the policymakers and opinion leaders who are supposed to save us, help us de-ghettoize our cities, help us stop the urbanization that displaces those who can no longer afford to live there? At the one time, they were substantial working-class people who had no debt and had quality of life. They're gone. And what about all the children who can't eat because they have no money and because they have parents who are not making enough and creating, therefore, food insecurity? They don't count. What about the students with debt of $1.6 trillion? They don't count. So they're saying, in effect, these four inner circles, that 70% of the entire American population don't count, and they are correct. You see, privilege does strange and unpleasant things to human beings, according to Chris Hedges. I saw these distortions, and you have too. Living in privilege spawns callousness, narcissism, even cruelty to those less fortunate, and feeds a bottomless greed. The repugnant characteristics of the rich are skillfully masked by armies of lawyers and publicists, a servile and intimidating press, good manners, and the fig leaf of philanthropy. Jeff Bezos, Jamie Dimon, Bill Gates, Jimmy Wells, Peter Thiel, John Mackey, and the late Steve Jobs and David Koch. But whatever their carefully packaged public image, championed economic and social models that are designed to create a new form of serfdom for the working class and further consolidate the concentration of wealth and power into the hands of the oligarchs. When a society falls into the death grip of an oligarch class, the result is always catastrophic. Why? Because oligarchs live insulated lives surrounded by courtiers that cater to their bottomless narcissism and hedonism. They wield power based upon fantasy. They propagate ruling ideologies such as neoliberalism and the intellectually and morally bankrupt writings of Ayn Rand, which are not economically rational but justify their privilege. Their mantra, first uttered by a notorious serial killer and enthusiastically embraced by Rand, is, what is good for me is right. All of our institutions, the press, the courts, legislative bodies, the executive branch, and academia, have been perverted to serve the oligarchs' narrow, selfish interests while an oppressed citizenry struggling to survive is seething with mounting rage and frustration. The corporate coup orchestrated by the ruling oligarchs over the past few decades gave us Donald Trump. If this coup is not reversed, far worse will follow. The oligarchs are the last to understand the consequences of their moral depravity. The political reformers such as Bernie Sanders could save the system from self-destruction are demonized in the same way the Russian oligarchs demonize Alexander Kerensky, the socialist revolutionaries, and Mensheviks, paving the way for the tyrannical Bolsheviks under Vladimir Lenin. Even the end comes, and the end will come, most probably in our case, with a tyrannical imposed by Christian fascists. The oligarchs will be blissfully unaware, gorging themselves at their palatial estates or on their mega yachts like the clueless French or Russian aristocracy on the eve of the revolutions. So, the spirit of meanness corrupts the far right and the far left. It defines the Christian fascists and the alt-right as it defines many in Antifa and the Black Bloc. Although unlike their fascist opponents, the far left in the United States is a marginally poorly organized, ideologically bankrupt, and ineffectual political force. As societies polarize, the attempts by reformers and moderates such as Sanders and Gabbard to halt the disorder, diffuse the mounting hatreds and antagonisms that are increasingly expressed through violence and savage democratic norms, prove fruitless. The oligarchs do not respond to their appeals, and eventually the disenfranchised lose patience with the impotence of the moderates. Lenin's ruthlessness and rule by decree and terror, enforced by death squads run by the Cheka, reflected the ruthlessness and terror employed by the Russian aristocracy and the Okhrama, the Committee for People's Safety, which assured dictatorial powers for September 1793 to July 1794 during the French Revolution, reflected the ruthlessness and terror employed by the French nobility. Extremists, no matter what their political platform, are remarkably similar once in power, and it is almost always extremists who inherit power in failed democracies. So when we look at the world today, let us look honestly for those who are honest. Let us have empathy for those who need it and deserve it. But let us look unblinkingly with a 1,000-watt light into the rest of every one of our social systems and paradigms and ask, my goodness, how did this happen? And the answer is simple. It happened when we stopped caring about the consequences of actions and people beyond our own immediate needs. We've been living too much of a small life. And as a result, we're not willing to look at the big picture, the interconnectivity of those in power, and how they don't only not like us, they disdain us. And that's why I suggest that you become more aware, because on tomorrow's program, I'll be showing you what they're now intending to do with some smart cards that you must have. They're actually trying to pass legislation that everybody must have a smart card, or you won't be able to get on an airplane. You won't be able to go to a movie theater. You won't be able to go to a concert. You won't be able to get on a subway. You will find your life substantially different. This isn't some dystopian future idea. This is happening right now. And that's why, as long as I heard someone like that person in the earlier part of our program saying, I trusted you all until what? 2 months ago? Till your own child became sick? But you trusted everyone? You trusted the CIA, the National Security Agency? You trusted the advertisers on big media? You trusted everybody? You trusted the food that they were serving you, causing your diabetes and your high blood pressure and your child's diabetes and ADD and ADHD? You trusted all the vaccines they got? You trusted all the genetically engineered material food that you were eating? You trusted the so-called objectiveness of Wikipedia, the objectiveness of MSNBC and CNN and the New York Times? You questioned nothing? There was nothing to question. You didn't question Libya and the destruction of an entire highly evolved culture, the most prosperous, educated, longest-lived, healthiest and wealthiest people in Africa, 54 countries, you trusted them to do the right thing. You trusted the white helmets. You trusted the invasion of Syria. You trusted the regime change. You trusted everything being done in the world in the name of neoliberalism. And now it came to your door, and now you're angry. Wow. I'm Gary Knoll. Have a nice day.
Turn off the lights and light a candle. Tonight I'm in a romantic mood. Yeah. Let's take a shower together. I'll wash your body. Wash my, yeah.